You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine, March 3rd, 2024. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with a featured story, the featured story from the magazine, Why Are Pants So Big Again? And what the latest swing from skinny to wide tells us about ourselves. There's a picture that accompanies the title. It shows, of course, young man, arms crossed in a white shirt and wearing some huge bluish denim pants with big black shoes. This is a story by Jonah Weiner. At some point in the past few years, as if we didn't have enough to worry about, everyone's pants started to look wrong. For an improbably long time, the right pants, meaning those that conveyed some socially agreed upon baseline level of stylishness, had been, in a word, small. Snug through the thighs, throttled at the knees, close cut at the calves, on intimate terms with the ankles, running a minuscule gamut from skinny to the slightly more accommodating slim. There were exceptions, particularly when it came to women's pants, but on balance, fitted was the way good pants were supposed to fit. My pants had been slim for some 15 years, since so-called skinny jeans first hit the market in earnest around 2005. Narrow silhouettes quickly spread until they felt less like a trend and more like a structural fact of existence. A decade after their ascendance, slim-fit pants remained common currency across generations, demographics, and body types. BTS, at the time, the biggest pop group in the world, wore them. Underground Chicago drill rappers wore them, too. Hollywood leading men, neighborhood baristas, wedding planners and basketball players, morning show hosts and accountants, youth pastors and construction workers, your nephew and your aunt. You might have wondered if we'd reached the end of pants. And then, in a rupture whose center I place within the broader pandemic era upheavals of 2020, the right pants began to lurch away from the leg at scale. Jeans, a kind of patient zero for pants trends, showed symptoms of acute onset elephantitis. Stylish friends of mine and strangers whose outfits I googled online abandoned their slim-fit denim for straight-leg vintage Levi's 501s, something like the Greenwich Mean Time of modern pants, and then swiftly abandoned those for ever ampler models. Paul O'Neill, the global design director for Levi's, told me that in recent years he noticed a rise in kids hitting thrift stores to buy jeans with a size 46 or 48 waist and belting them to get that oversized look. He made some of the company's biggest ever pants in response, and even baggier ones were in the works. Month by month, pants got puffier, growing higher rises and sprouting more and more pleats. Hemlines that once severely tapered now expanded, hovering like UFOs above shoes or pooling atop them like swirls of soft-serve ice cream. On Instagram, fashion mood board accounts, which aggregate aspirational imagery, did an increasingly brisk trade in photographs from the late 80s and early 90s of people wearing billowing trousers by Ralph Lauren, Giorgio Armani, and Yohji Yamamoto. All manner of pants polarities rapidly inverted themselves. Perhaps the most epical illustration concerned of all people, Barack Obama. 2009, he threw the first pitch at the All-Star Game wearing shapeless, wide-leg Levi's, uncool dad jeans at the time. They inspired widespread ridicule because the way pants fit is a kind of lingua franca. Even people who claim not to care at all about clothes feel qualified to judge. A decade later, though, those kinds of dad jeans were looking better than ever, and here were photos of Obama pushing 60 in far too tight, far too cropped chinos during a visit to Kuala Lumpur. Looking at these pictures side by side, we had incontrovertible proof. Skinny pants were the real dad pants now. You might still be wearing them, but they were no longer right. In some ways, this shift felt entirely predictable, as if a rubber band stretched tight and snapped back to laxity. And yet it was disconcerting, too, as if the rubber band had immediately become a balloon. It can be hard to trust your own eyes. I've been feeling the rumblings of a return to big pants since around 2017, when I remember worrying about the fact that I was 36 and still wearing essentially the same pants I'd worn at 26. There's constancy, I thought, and then there's becoming a relic of yourself. The balding guy still trying to make his high school haircut work. I made the conscious decision to resist fossilization and buy roomier pants. And over the next couple of years, I thought that's what I did. My wife and my friends tell me they thought I did too, having seen some of the new pants in question and deemed them conspicuously, if not laughably, large. And yet photographs confirm that, in absolute terms, my pants remained fitted for a while. I couldn't see it clearly at first, but I was locked in an arms race against my own mounting pants dysmorphia. Trousers that struck me as audaciously large yesterday looked correct today. By tomorrow, I would wonder if they weren't actually a bit close clinging. The balloon just kept expanding. Casting about for signs of the times, pants-wise, I noticed that the influential, idiosyncratically stylish rapper Tyler, the Creator, once seen only in slim jeans and cut-off shorts, took to full-fitting slacks. 2019, the pop star Harry Styles began exploring a gender-fluid style that included expansively flared sailor's pants, and for a Vogue cover shoot, a big, ruffly dress. February 2021, the fashion critic Rachel Tashiden tweeted a photo from the Oscars of the Danish film editor Mikael E. G. Nielsen in trousers whose tent-like expanse could have accommodated two of him. Folks, this is pants history unfolding before our eyes, she declared. After years of tiny, tight, overly tailored pants, big trousers returned to the red carpet. At subsequent award shows, Lakeith Stanfield, Paul Mescal, and Eddie Redmayne were among those to follow in Nielsen's extravagantly enswirled footsteps. There's a picture here of Harry Styles in 2023 with some very large pants on. In late 2022, J. Crew, that historical paragon of right-thinking mainstream sartorialism, released a new gargantuan pair of flat-front chinos. They had a vast, blocky rise. The hemlines boasted dinner plate-sized circumferences. J. Crew called them giant-fit chinos. They doubtless came as a shock to some office casual types who'd long burrowed into the snug, familiar confines of tapered, stretch-fit trousers. But of course, other observers scoffed. These things weren't even that big. Throughout the tumult, I consulted a screenshot I'd saved to my desktop. It was a 2021 tweet from the comedian Noah Garfinkel, who distilled the spiraling epistemological vertigo around pants into an absurdist fashion koan. Whatever style pants look like, expletive, to you are the pants you're supposed to wear, he wrote. And as soon as they start to look normal to you, those are not the right pants anymore. You should always be wearing pants you think look stupid. to state what's obvious, I care a lot about pants. I'm tempted to say that I care too much about them, but because we often frame a preoccupation with clothes as vain, frivolous, and otherwise regrettable. It certainly can be those things, but I try to make sense of it as an abiding fascination with the beautiful, funny, fraught workings of a visual language that all of us speak all the time, deftly or ineptly, consciously or not. It's a language whose stakes are heightened because unless we count nudists and hermits, there's no way to opt out of speaking it, not to mention that it can be disorientingly difficult to know when a particular phrasing originated within you and when the words you're speaking have been placed in your mouth from industry puppet masters on high. In 2020, I started writing a newsletter about style and culture called Blackbird Spy Plane. Perhaps the most common question from readers concerned, you guessed it, pants. Specifically, how should they fit now? This is because among clothes, pants command a unique and uniquely vexing signifying power. No other garment we routinely wear is as totemic, as eloquent, or as problematic. One pants-preoccupied friend of mine, the Wall Street Journal fashion writer Jacob Gallagher, has called pants the core of an outfit. The GQ fashion editor Samuel Hine, a dedicated pants Talmudist, recently described them to me as the most essential garment you can wear. Even those of us with zero avowed interest in fashion are prone to feel anxiety, vulnerability, and dissatisfaction around our pants. Larry David once said that trying on pants is one of the most humiliating things a man can suffer. In a 2021 interview, David Lynch, a master of the dread that lurks beneath the surface of the quotidian, confessed, "I am searching for a good pair of pants. I never found a pair of pants that I just love," adding, "If they're not right, which they never are, it's a sadness." Some reasons for the power of pants are abstract and cultural, and others are straightforwardly material. As the writer Sophie Thanhouser phrases it in her indispensable 2022 book, Worn, A People's History of Clothing, garment making is, quote, a trade based on fantasy as much as it is on necessity. At the heart of the fantasy is the notion that by wearing the right clothes the right way, we can bring the way we look into deeper harmony with the way we wish we looked. A century ago, a woman wearing pants represented a symbolic appropriation, outre to some, liberatory to others, of masculine-coded power. Today, there's nothing scandalous about the sight of a woman in pants, in that they remain inextricable from the enforcement and subversion of gender norms, even as they prove semiotically slippery in this exact regard. At some points, big pants have read as manly and skinny ones as feminine. At other points, these valences have flipped perfectly. And there's a picture there with Bobby Doherty. And it's a woman with a blue top, hands akimbo on her hips, white belt, and huge green pants. In strictly physical terms, no article of clothing does more to articulate and augment the lines of our bodies, to beautify us or deform us, than pants. They tend to occupy the most visual square footage in any given outfit. They also tend to move more than other clothes as our bodies move through the world, which creates more inflection points where they can attract notice and where they can go wrong. A t-shirt is so much simpler, Hines said. A sweater is so much simpler. Even with a button-up, you can fake it, roll up the sleeves, unbutton the neck. But there's no place to hide in a bad-fitting pair of pants. Pants are diabolical as design objects, Hine went on. You can look at the measurements for the waist and the inseam, but that won't tell you anything besides how they fit in two places, when there's so many other variables, the rise, the hemline, fabric weight, drape. It's an object that throughout history was made by tailors and craftsmen, and when it got mass-produced and casualized, what happened was they took this really intricate garment and tried to tell us everyone can wear this every day, and it'll be easy to find a pair that makes sense for your body. But it's actually an enormous challenge. It's a challenge whether you're a self-identifying clothes horse or someone who simply doesn't want to look comically out of touch, like Obama on the pitcher's mound. This is a big part of why trends around the right pants tend to move so slowly. Once you find a style you like, or once you acquiesce to the style you're supposed to like and then hope your perception adjusts accordingly, it's reasonable to want to drop anchor. That was particularly true with a style as extreme as slim pants, which required a leap of faith for lots of people to accept in the first place. Skinny silhouettes were, in hindsight, a highly unlikely proposition for mass adoption, not just physically constrictive, but also revealing to a degree that could verge on a violation of privacy. And yet, in short order, the ultra-slim look flowed outward from tip-of-the-spear European jeans makers like Cheap Monday and APC to elevated mall brands like J. Crew. Influential designer labels like Band of Outsiders and Dior Homme made slim fit synonymous with a chic, faintly roguish urbanity, and Tom Brown went one further, cutting trousers not just tight, but also high, positing the exposed male ankle as its own sort of statement accessory. Fast fashion chains like Zara and H&M peddled unisex pantomimes of these skinny upmarket styles, and before long, so did mass retail behemoths like Old Navy and Target, signaling and consolidating small pants' grip on the zeitgeist. The relatively glacial pace of pants trends helps explain why they work so well as time stamps for bygone eras. There's no straightforwardly legible connection between the defining character of an era and the shape of its trousers. Big pants and skinny pants have flourished during economic boom times and depressions. You could drop Charlie Chaplin's Tramp into a circa 2024 fashion mood board pretty readily. During wartime and peace, Democrat and Republican presidencies, but if you're trying to date an old photograph by the clothes people are wearing, I'd argue that among the many possible clues available to you, lapel sizes, color combinations, shoe styles, hair accessories, the way pants fit offers the most reliable and pungent index of a given time. On Instagram in 2019, the style-savvy musician John Mayer delivered a tongue-in-cheek lecture on this subject that concluded with a call to get dressed from the pants out. We think about the 1950s, and we might picture leather biker jackets, but we definitely picture dark indigo straight-leg jeans with fat, flipped-up cuffs. We think of the late 60s and the 70s, and we picture bell-bottoms. The 80s, pegged and acid-washed jeans, and then toward decade's end, voluminous Armani-style trousers. That voluminousness held into the 90s, moderated a bit in the baggy chinos and corduroys of Gap, J. Crew, and Polo. And then, thanks to a youth culture increasingly infatuated with skateboarders, rappers, ravers, and drug dealers, pants got as wide as ever, wider even than in the 30s and 40s, when high-waisted, lavishly pleated, shoe-swallowing trousers dominated, but with classical tailoring nowhere in evidence on an unruly, engulfing pair of jeans made circa 1995 by J&CO or Carl Connie. As the millennium neared, and through the early 2000s, volume diminished along the leg in stages. Rises dropped, exposing hip bones and midriffs, and silhouettes slimmed at the thigh. The last remaining vestige of mid-90s enormousness was a bootcut flare at the calf, which finally dissipated when the slim pant took its throne. Of course, word of the king's death hasn't reached everyone yet. Sagar de la Rai, a very stylish man who owns one of my favorite clothing shops, the Vancouver-based neighbor, told me that over the holidays he got a drink with some guys he plays hockey with. I was wearing loose jeans and everyone was wearing slim pants. Maybe too slim, Delivery recalled, and one of them came up to me and said, back in the day, we all wore loose pants. Then we were told slim pants are cool. So now we're all wearing slim pants. You're the only one here wearing loose pants. Are the trends changing again? And if in 2024 pants feel unsettled, it's not only because of the consensus around the right pants has whipped so precipitously from small to big, but also because at the very same time, a more fundamentally nagging question has started to creep up. Is there actually anything resembling consensus around trends anymore? When we try to impose coherent sense onto trends and all their vast and ungainly workings, we often reach for cyclical metaphors, whereby past styles are understood to loop back around, given enough time, in an endless recurrence. If you zoom out far enough, all the paroxysms around self-presentation arrange themselves into an orderly, eminently predictable swing between big and small. You could call it the pants pendulum. But the tidiness of such metaphors runs into trouble in the internet age, where trends accelerate, proliferate, and fragment across a multitude of demographics and subcultures. Information that once moved at the relatively manageable pace of movies, magazines, and seasonal runway collections can now travel from early adopters to latecomers in the span of a few weeks, if not days. That's been true since the early 2000s, but it has been abetted in the past few years by a few factors. One is an explosion in the online resale market, a profusion of vintage and secondhand platforms like Grailed, Debop, and the RealReal, along with an innumerable flurry of Instagram-based vintage shops, have joined eBay to make clothes from all previous eras readily shoppable, at least theoretically. Now you can rummage, time travel, and trend hop through bygone styles as never before. Another factor is the unholy churn of fast fashion, a business model epitomized by notorious brands like Fashion Nova and Shine, whose output makes older fast fashion merchants look quaint. Shine, for its part, puts out thousands of new styles a day, inconceivable kilotons of cheap, essentially disposable clothes produced in response to the most flitting tremors of consumer demand. The result is a mounting sense not merely that more trends are happening all at once, but that all trends are happening all at once. While there's some truth to this, I'm not sure it's the whole story, because when I look at the long dominance of slim pants, I also see evidence, much like when I look at the long dominance of the Marvel Comics universe, only freshly on the wane, or the long dominance of Taylor Swift, no waning in sight, that a powerful monoculture can survive the hyper-fragmentary internet age just fine. After all, our relationship to clothes unfolds in the context of a garment industry comparable in scale to agriculture and fossil fuels, an industry that, as such, requires economies of scale vast enough and concentrations of demand broad enough to ensure profitability. For our part, we tend to wear the clothes we wear not just because we like them, but also because we want to telegraph our taste, cultural affiliations, social status to other people. This game of signaling gets less fun if too many people can read our cues. But it breaks down entirely if in the opposite scenario, in which no one picks up on our cues at all because everyone speaks in a different tongue. A tower of Babel for pants. Neither the would-be garment seller nor the would-be outfit flaunter can operate in the absence of some sufficiently widespread shared lexicon of taste and desire. And that would seem to put a hard limit on just how fragmented things can get. What does seem inarguable is that these days more people care about self-presentation than ever, owing to the fact that between dating app selfies, social media fit pics, TikTok-style tutorial accounts, get-ready-with-me videos, Discord servers, and other gaping digital maws to feed with visual evidence of ourselves, there is simply more self-presenting happening than ever. We're all image makers on our personal platforms now, as GQ's Hine put it to me. The pandemic accelerated many trends in the virtualization of life, assembling outfits as much for your digital self as for the one who moves through the physical world is one of them. Against that backdrop, feels like no coincidence that the extreme of skinny pants gave way so rapidly to the extreme of big pants. This has been a moment in fashion characterized by extremes more than anything, because extremes are what play best on phone screens. We see this in recent vogues for eye-popping graphic tees, for viral novelty footwear like the big red boots, and for so-called haul videos, where the point is to flaunt a staggering volume of new acquisitions. We also see it, less intuitively, in the countervailing vogue for quiet luxury, style of dressing that is putatively about tasteful restraint. No logos, no garish de classe patterns. But in actual practice is deafening in its emphasis on soft, pampering fabrics, excessive volumes, sumptuous hues, and never far from mind, astronomical pricing. Where fashion and technology converge is in their mutual dependence on novelty and obsolescence. Products need to phase out so that different products can phase in, and the current swing to big pants might prove nothing more than a brief overcorrection after the long reign of small ones. There's some reason to be bullish about the chances of mainstream big pants hegemony. J. Crew now offers the giant fit chino in a range of colors, and Madewell, whose customer is similar, recently relaunched its men's line with a bunch of wide and baggy pants styles. 2022, Levi's rolled out a reissue of its infamously wide 90s-era silver tab jeans with Kohl's as mass market a retailer as you can imagine. And yet, some people think skinny is bound to make a swift comeback. Slim pants were surprisingly well represented on designer runways in January, and I'm already seeing an uptick in Y2K-style ultra-low-rise flares. If the internet hasn't broken the pants pendulum, where is the pendulum right now, exactly? The best we can do is argue. Late last year, a popular user on X, who posts under the name Internet Hippo, went viral with an image of arrows arranged in a clockwise circle. There was a pair of skinny jeans at 12 o'clock, baggy jeans at 6 o'clock, and a red marker indicating 4 o'clock. I believe we are approximately here in the society pants cycle, a caption declared. Some 147,000 people liked the tweet, and across more than 2,000 responses, debate ensued about the lines you'd expect. This is too early, this is too late, who cares? Wear whatever you like. Wear whatever you like has long struck me as up there with be yourself when it comes to useless style advice. as if your personal style didn't always contain some irreducible level of dialogue with the tastes, prerogatives, and opinions of others, as if taste were something that could ever take the form of pure monologue. And yet, as fascinated as I am with pants, scrolling through the replies, I felt nothing so strongly as the urge to escape the society pants cycle entirely, to step off the carousel once and for all. Over the past few years, I've come into possession of several beloved pants whose fit on a binary is big. I'm very happy with them, and all things being equal, if we want clothes to transform us, then a pair of pants with more fabric than less would seem to present more potential for interesting and felicitous transformations than is possible in the more austere, monotone idiom of slim fit. So why can't I forget about the pants pendulum? Gracefully bow out here and settle into, if not a uniform, something similarly unbudging. Part of me thinks it's possible, imagining myself wearing these pants for decades to come. I'm heartened by the fact that when I see older men in big pants, they typically look great, whereas older men in skinny pants seem a bit confused about how old they are. It's funny, there's an age before which it's actively commendable to explore and make mistakes, and an age after which exploration and mistake-making become the embarrassing evidence of a lost soul. Look at those pants. This poor bastard still doesn't have it figured out. But that, in the end, might be the biggest fantasy that attaches to clothes, namely, that any of us can ever have it figured out, arriving at a place of such self-knowledge that we no longer err. The way you look in clothes is, in fact, a profoundly flawed and paradoxical marker of self-knowledge, because the way you look in clothes is, ultimately, not just up to you, it's up to other people. What's more, as with any social compact, it's subject to an endlessly shifting, inescapable array of historical contingencies and aesthetic renegotiations, or as we familiarly describe them, trends. That's why David Lynch has never found his perfect pair of pants. Because David Lynch's perfect pants, much like David Lynch's perfect self, do not and cannot exist. That impossibility could drive us nuts, or we could embrace it. Take it as a license to play around with how we see ourselves, to keep testing the borders of our comfort zones, trying on different selves, one pair of pants at a time. In this light, Noah Garfinkel's joke about how you should always be wearing pants you think look stupid might contain some of the wisest style advice I've encountered. Your capacity for stupidity is how you know you're still alive. Recently, a late period portrait of Miles Davis, as universal an avatar of coolness as modernity has produced, made the rounds on style-focused corners of the internet. This was not the natty circa 1950s Oxford button-up and slim trousers Miles Davis were used to seeing. He has long hair, tiny sunglasses. He's leaning against a white Ferrari Testarossa. His name is on the license plate. But none of that is the focal point. The focal point is Davis's enormous pants. They're tan with deep pleats and a towering rise, and they pool behind the tongues of his white loafers like tidal waves converging on a couple of dinghies. They are large, but not structureless. They echo and expand on his stance with a graceful excess, the way a sail echoes and expands on the wind. They look tremendously, gorgeously, inspiringly stupid. I think there's a lesson in this picture for those of us who wear pants. Even the 100% of us who are not Miles Davis. As I write this paragraph, I'm sitting in a pair of wide-legged, double-pleated, dusty, eggplant-colored corduroys. When I glance down at them, they feel stupid to me in the most pleasingly strange, personally appropriate way possible. When I get up and walk around, the way they slosh around my legs strikes me as even stupider. I love them. Maybe the best I can do is hope that my pants feel like this for a very long time, and that if the day comes when they don't, then I'm not too tired, too proud to find another pair of pants this stupid. The author, Jonah Weiner, is a contributing writer based in Oakland, California. He writes Blackbird's Spy Plane, a style and culture newsletter with Aaron Wiley. I'll read from the Screenland section of the magazine. Sports anchors went all in on outrage. Then there's Scott Van Pelt. If you're tired of the endless manufactured arguments by modern sports personalities, his Midnight Sports Center is a safe harbor. Just under the title is a picture of Scott when he was much younger. This is a story by Jonathan Mahler. Scott Van Pelt materializes on screen 5 nights a week at midnight, sometimes a little earlier or later, typically in a necktie and pocket square, the spotlight reflecting off his bald head, ready to talk about the day in sports. There will be highlights, analysis, commentary, and depending on when you tune in, maybe a funny bit. On Mondays, he and his sidekick, Stanford Steve, deliver Bad Beats, a Letterman-style compilation of the plays behind the week's most brutal gambling losses. The meaningless three-pointer at the buzzer that busted bettors on the under. The late fumble and pointless touchdown that prevented the winning team from covering. Van Pelt likes to say that he just tries to be himself on air. If we take him at his word about that, it's safe to say that he's thoughtful, wry, self-aware, and occasionally sentimental. Also, that he's not aggressive, obnoxious, or particularly opinionated, but makes him a rarity among today's sports media personalities. Van Pelt is the anchor of the late-night edition of ESPN's Sports Center, the one made famous in the 1990s by Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick. He's been the face of the show, once the network's hottest franchise, now more of a comfort watch for sports fans of a certain disposition, for going on 10 years. Even as the network and the entire sports entertainment complex has simultaneously blown up and melted down around him, he's the last man standing amid a ceaseless and ongoing sports media revolution. Paradoxically, it was the late-night Sports Center telecast that helped ignite this revolution in the first place. It's impossible to overstate how big a deal the show was in its prime. Practically speaking, it was the only place to get all of the day's sports scores and highlights. The staccato opening bars of its theme music, da-da-da-da-da-da, was like a late dinner bell for sports fans. But SportsCenter was much more than a sports news show. It was a cultural phenomenon. The catchphrases that its hosts unspooled on the air, en fuego, cool as the other side of the pillow, Yahtzee, seeped into the broader culture, as did the patter speak surrounding them. SportsCenter was a tone and an attitude, droll, irreverent, fun, maybe best embodied by its cheeky, perfect-pitch commercials, usually filmed in ESPN's generic corporate offices. And my favorite, a bird-themed mascot carrying lunch bumps into the glass wall of a conference room, interrupting a meeting being run by the anchor, Stuart Scott, who doesn't flinch. Moments later, a different bird mascot does exactly the same thing. "Seriously?" Scott deadpans. "We have got to get this glass frosted." That tone and attitude would extend far beyond ESPN itself. SportsCenter created the archetype of the smart, fast-talking sports broadcaster that clearly inspired Aaron Sorkin's first foray into television, the short-lived Sports Night, which is to say that dialogue we now think of as Sorkin-esque, owes a debt to Patrick and Olbermann. The language that would be branded as an aspirational kind of Americanese in the West Wing was gestated in the world of sports. Most influentially, SportsCenter redefined sports news in much the way that its neighboring cable channels redefined news. Games, like major news events, were relatively rare, at least when you needed to fill 24 hours of programming, but you could also entertain viewers with conversations about those games. Those conversations might even be considered news themselves. To entertain viewers, though, ESPN needed its anchors to be entertaining. A tricky proposition for a network that was billing itself as the worldwide leader in sports and was therefore a place where personalities had to remain subservient to the bigger brand. That brand was sports, not politics. Olbermann had been one kind of cable TV star at ESPN. He became a very different one as the host of Countdown with Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. Van Pelt, who joined ESPN from the Golf Channel in 2001, is a creature of this culture. He's an anchor more than a personality, part of the product rather than the product in himself. And today's sports language, that makes him increasingly unique. ESPN is still the worldwide leader in sports, but the challenges to its cultural and financial supremacy are immense. Streaming has disrupted its revenue model, and competing outlets from Fox Sports to Barstool Sports to The Ringer are forever threatening its grip on the attention of sports fans. When a meaningful game isn't on, there are countless places fans can go to get their fix, especially now that athletes have discovered the power and reach of sports media and started providing access to the makers of unscripted shows like Netflix's Breakpoint. ESPN has had to amp things up to keep pace. In this respect, the style and pitch of its commentary have evolved with our broader culture. Sports aren't politics, but that doesn't mean you can't argue about them stridently and endlessly. ESPN has long since given up on trying to contain the personality of its hosts. On the contrary, one of the network's biggest stars is Stephen A. Smith, Screamin' Stephen, who has turned hot takes into a form of performance art, manufacturing outrage over pretty much anything. Actual politics are a much more complicated issue. ESPN dabbled in them several years ago, hiring Jemele Hill as a host for a 6 p.m. edition of SportsCenter after NFL players started criticizing the police and kneeling during the national anthem. But the network appeared to have second thoughts when Hill called President Donald Trump a white supremacist on Twitter, and she left the company a year later. Another ESPN star right now, Pat McAfee, is a perfect emblem of the predicament the company has found itself in. He's a former Indianapolis Colts punter turned tank top wearing YouTuber whose show came to the network in the fall, bringing with it, ESPN surely hopes, a loyal following of younger sports fans, raised not on wry broadcasters, but on in-your-face online influencers. McAfee certainly makes news. One of his frequent guests, the New York Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers, recently implied on McAfee's show that the late-night host Jimmy Kimmel might be on a list of people linked to Jeffrey Epstein's underage sex ring. In a post on X, Kimmel refuted this claim and threatened legal action. This marriage between an uncontrollable talent and a corporate entity calls to mind the precarious and ill-fated union between Tucker Carlson and Fox News. Through it all, Van Pelt carries on. ESPN gave him the Midnight Sports Center in 2015, offering him the opportunity to save the fading franchise. He has made it his own without ever making it about him. In the process, he has come to stand for the increasingly subversive notion that you don't have to be loud or combative or provocative to hold your audience's attention. That intelligence, charm, and humor still resonate. He's a safe harbor in the modern sports world. Van Pelt is 57. A few years ago, he moved the Midnight Sports Center from ESPN's campus in Bristol, Connecticut, to Washington, D.C., so he could be closer to his family. He recently told a podcaster for Sports Illustrated, another outlet that is struggling to figure out how to stay relevant, that he doesn't intend to do the show much longer. But until that day comes, he'll be at his desk 5 nights a week, the last link to a time when witty, cerebral anchors ruled the sports world, and proof that we often like our media personalities more when they are able to recede into a format, when they don't make themselves the stars of the show. The author, Jonathan Mahler, is a staff writer for the Times Magazine and the author of Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, and The Challenge. I'll read a letter to the ethicist. Is shoplifting okay if the shop owner is awful? The magazine's ethicist columnist on the moral implications of a friend's stealing habit. Close friend of mine many years, whom I've always thought of as an extremely honest, ethical person, recently confided in me that she shoplifts on a regular basis. She explains that she never steals from small or independently owned businesses, only from large companies, and only when no small business nearby carries the items she needs. She targets companies that are known to treat their employees badly, or that knowingly source their products from places where human rights are violated, or whose owners, CEOs, donate to ultra-conservative, authoritarian-leaning candidates, etc. My friend volunteers in her community and has worked her entire life for nonprofit, anti-poverty, and human rights organizations. While she isn't wealthy, she's able to afford the items she steals and believes that she is redistributing wealth. She says she keeps track of the value of what she's stolen and donates an equal amount to charity. She thinks of her actions as civil disobedience and says she will accept the consequences if she's caught. When she told me, I thought stealing is wrong. But as we discussed it, I realized I was oversimplifying a complex moral issue. Is it wrong to steal food to feed your starving children? What if I stole a legally purchased gun from a person I knew was about to commit a mass shooting? Are those who bring office supplies home from their workplace also thieves? I find myself struggling with the question of whether an individual's actions are morally defensible if they do more good than harm. Name was withheld. And the ethicist writes, let's start by asking what your friend thinks she's doing. Is the aim to produce social change? Evidently not, because she isn't letting these corporations and their bosses know what's happening. This isn't a consumer boycott. They can't consider shifting policies in response. And anyway, her pilferage isn't on a scale that would be detectable at a corporate level. So perhaps she just wants to diminish the coffers of the wicked, even if it makes no practical difference to them. Insofar as the cost of shoplifting is passed on to other consumers, though, the redistribution to her is largely not from the corporations, but from other customers who don't steal. And here we have to consider the overall practice of shoplifting to which she's contributing. The moral and legal prescription of theft is meant to create a system that allows people to hold on to their possessions and dispose of them only when they choose to. Theft undermines this system, a system we all have reason to value and a duty to help sustain by keeping to the rules. Your light-fingered friend may protest that she steals only from retail outlets connected to bad actors. But the rest of us aren't picking and choosing in this way. We pay what we owe at the checkout counter. So she's taking advantage of our compliance without complying herself. Consider, too, that when the bosses of these corporations support candidates and causes she deplores, they're exercising their rights as citizens. A world in which we all feel free to violate the rights of people whose politics we don't share, her conservative counterparts could target those they thought were spreading the woke mind virus, would be a world without the benefits of democracy. For your friend, shoplifting may be a thrill-seeking activity with real psychological rewards by imagining yourself to be the Dexter of the retail aisles, channeling illicit desires into supposed acts of consumer vigilantism. She's able to maintain a belief in her own righteousness, but this is a delusion you shouldn't indulge. In fact, the three cases of permissible theft you mentioned provide a useful set of contrasts. People who steal to feed a starving family confront conflicting rights claims. They're forced to violate the property rights of strangers to do their duty to their dependents. In a decent society, they wouldn't be faced with this choice. But your friend isn't making a choice out of necessity, and there are no rights she's advancing. Her actions aren't aimed at getting the corporations to do better. What about swiping a gun that you believe is about to be used in the commission of a serious crime? Here, you're temporarily interfering with the rights of the owner in order to protect the rights of the prospective victims. Stopping a crime, not securing retribution, is the objective. Your friend can make no such claim. As for the pens and pencils that may travel home with you from the workplace, employers generally accept some amount of this, especially given that so many people do so much work at home. But if you take more than what's reasonable in the light of that consideration, then yes, what you're doing is wrong. Which leads me to a final point. How bad a theft is depends on how it affects the welfare of others. What your friend is doing is wrong, but it's not very wrong. Mainly, it's self-harming. She's exposing herself to serious reputational consequences should she be caught. Because you care about her, you should try to persuade her to drop her unfortunate hobby. And her insistence that it's fine to steal from others when you disapprove of them, she might see things differently if you pointed out that this rationale would encourage those of us who disapprove of theft to steal from her. And I'll end today with Judge John Hodgman on what's more gross: borrowing someone else's deodorant or someone else's toothbrush. David writes, "My friend Richard and I disagree about something. He says it's grosser to use someone else's deodorant than someone else's toothbrush. I completely disagree. Richard even posted a poll online a few years back. My side won, but not by enough. Which is grosser?" And the judge writes, "I am not a doctor, just a fake judge, but I feel confident that you're not going to contract any of your roommates' spit diseases from their deodorant unless you're rubbing it on your tongue. And as a fake doctor, I order you, do not do this. But you know the famous saying, grossness is in the armpit of the beholder. If swapping speed sticks makes Richard queasier than swapping saliva, that's his weird prerogative, just as it's my right to determine that Richard is disgusting. So long as you keep your toothbrush locked up around him, I will allow you to remain friends. But I don't want to know what he does with your floss." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.